And welcome to Cancqueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
What a week ahead of us. I managed to do a couple of interviews this week and got an interview with the LGBT Chamber of Commerce and the Inside Out Film Festival a little later today in the show. So, yeah, very exciting times. Sebastian,
yes.
How are you?
I'm all right.
Okay. Well, we have to dive in because we've got two interviews to get through. We have to cover some ground. And right. Let's start off with some good news because everyone needs a bit of good news. I need some good news. You need some good news.
Oh, I'm fine. I'm drinking Warrior's drink.
You're drinking the Warrior's drink? That's prune juice, isn't it?
Prune juice and whiskey, yeah.
Oh, my. Wow. That's a Warrior's drink. Wow.
Well, it's a homage to Worf, son of Nog. Obviously.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, with that in mind, are you aware of what the Swiss have done?
I was not telling you about this.
So they have actually cast the final vote approving same-sex marriage in Switzerland. This is very exciting for the Swiss.
Is this?
Yeah, we're quite excited about it.
Are you sure this is a 2020 story?
This is a 2020 story. They've been kind of on the fence about it since. All of that being said, this is great news from Switzerland. All joking aside, we want to congratulate folks. But yeah, we've been talking about it a little bit over the last few months as it sort of worked through one house to another, different levels of the Swiss government.
We are, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, you knew a little bit about Bhutan. Not Bhutan. But no. Bhutan. Tell me about the good news from Bhutan.
Well, I mean, the good news in short, the very brief news, is that homosexuality has been decriminalized. Now, the human rights status is not necessarily a glowing endorsement, but being decriminalized, it means that there's no more of the sort of draconian measures of, like, because I remember over the past few years, we have heard stories of, like, parties being raided and pride festivals being spied on and all that kind of thing. So being decriminalized is actually a very, very important start towards heading to equality. Mostly read story from the perspective of human rights advocates on the ground and how they're kind of excited that they can move on to other things like, you know, HIV prevention and domestic partner abuse and the kind of things that, quite frankly, is I don't want to say more important, because decriminalizing homosexuality pretty big thing, but you want to help people in their daily lives. So there, a lot of people are focusing on that a little bit more now that the good news has come through.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think there has definitely been some more pressing matters facing people in the last 8 to 12 months. I think that's certainly done something that has come up. And actually, you know, it's interesting that Bhutan recently made that decision, but the decision to decriminalize homosexuality in Canada was not without its opponents. We are talking about changes to the criminal code in the 60s. It was, 60-odd years ago here. Now, wow, 60 years. Jeez Louise. It was a while ago. But apparently some of the people who weren't keen on decriminalizing homosexuality in the 60s were the same people who had the joyous job of raiding gay bars, locking up the homosexuals. It was the various police associations actively opposed the decriminalization of homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And just recently, in a video message from the president of the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police, they have officially apologized to folks for opposing that decriminalization. It took them 60 years, but they have now realized that they were on the wrong side of history 60 years ago. So this is, you know, I am a little flippant about it because, of course, there are some folks who are still with us from 60 years ago.
Yeah.
Who this would be quite meaningful. This is important that the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police realizes it got it wrong. It was on the wrong side of history here. And
yeah.
There's a mea culpa.
And it's also kind of interesting from the other side of things as well, that there were politicians and officers, because I've read articles from that period where there are people who are like, we have better things to do than this. This is hard to enforce. It's taking up a lot of resources. 60s and 70s, there's huge crime waves happening. And people are like, do we have to do this? But these were not the chiefs. These were not the decision makers. This was like interviews with like staff sergeants and sergeants just basically saying, I don't know, I think I'd rather deal with kids on acid I don't know. This is me plumbing the depths of my memory. But yeah, no, it's...
Your memory from 60 years ago?
No. My memory of...
I mean, I know you're older than me, Seb, but I mean, I think that's a bit of a stretch. No,
memory of the articles that I've read.
All right. Mm-hmm. So I want to stick with this sort of rolling train of good news because I think we all need it a little bit. And that is some good news coming out of the UK. Now, the UK has been a little bit light on the good news front recently.
Oh, my God. They're doing everything wrong these days.
Well, they've done a couple of things. And the big thing they seem to have done right is they've decided that when it comes to blood donations, they're going to put their great big brushes that they've painted everybody, every single gay man with for the last 20, 30 years. They're putting those brushes away. Mm-hmm. Those nice big broad brushes. And according to the, it's called the FAIR. Let me just try and get the name of the organization. The National Health Service in the UK has decided that now they're going to figure out whether or not you are a risk in terms of donating blood based on what you have done individually as your own human. If you're out every Tuesday night popping random needles from the street into your arm, probably not keen on you donating blood.
Going to legs up parties.
Actually, there's a story on that one later. The FAIR Committee, which is the For Assessment of Individual Risk,
right,
which is a group with the NHS, mm-hmm. decided that, you know, definitely going to be the change of policy is they're going to individually ask each one. Yeah. So if you have been with the same-sex partner for the last 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, whatever it may be, there's no risk there. If you have been together for 3 months, you would know. A simple test would be able to show it. And, you know,
I mean, there's a risk that you'd be lying to the nurse.
There's a risk that a straight man walking in off the street could be lying to the nurse.
Exactly.
You know, there's a risk that a straight woman walking in off the street could be lying to the nurse. At which point you've eliminated, 80% of all people? Like, that's, you know.
And in the past, we had Gary Lacasse, head of the Canadian AIDS Association Society. He actually even agreed that, you know, like back in 83, it made sense. Just coverage, full ban on gay blood. 87 still kind of made sense because now we knew it was a sexually transmitted disease. By the late 90s, a little bit foggy. By the mid 2000s, what are you doing? It's now 2020. Although the last time we interviewed him, it was 2018. And he was just like, what are you doing? What are you doing? We have testing now. Like, what is this? Well,
now, under this new system, the NHS is taking a look at each case individually. Who is more at risk? Mm-hmm. Somebody in a stable relationship where there is a known sexual history, or an eccentric European politician who attends legs up parties. I know which one I would want to donate blood. This, I think, is the end goal that we've all been working towards. You know, we understand that we don't want to put folks at risk. We don't want to put the supply at risk.
Right.
Donation, you know, there's a questionnaire and it's individual and it's individual for everybody else unless you're gay, in which case it's a blanket nope. Mm-hmm. Unless you want to cross your legs for 3 months, which is also an option.
Or staple your knees together.
Stapling your knees together, good option. I mean, for Canada, this may provide a path forward.
You do realize, despite your becoming accent, that we are no longer a colony and that we can make our own decisions.
I've been spending time with the family, so yeah, it's definitely coming back a little bit.
Now, that said, so Australia has done things based on what Canada's done, and Canada's done things based on what, like, South Africa has done. So we do imitate each other to some degree. It's
the Food and Drug Administration in the US, the FDA, has launched a new study called ADVANCE that's assessing donor variability and new concepts in eligibility. Somebody worked really hard to get a good acronym out of that. I want to give a kudos to the acronym guy.
I almost spat up my drink.
But the whole point of ADVANCE from the FDA is they are looking specifically, is there a better way of doing this? And they have a quite tight timeline to get a better model in place. They've teamed up with the three largest centers, and it seems like the UK could be putting a path forward. The FDA may come up with a different approach altogether, but there's definitely a feeling that the status quo is just insufficient.
Well, there's been a blood shortage for like 15 years now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's definitely some good news. You know what I saw recently? The prom. On Netflix. Have you seen it?
No.
It's it's a Ryan Murphy movie, and of course he is one of Hollywood's most prolific openly gay content creators that we have in terms of creating movies. His American Horror Story series was recently stalled by COVID again. I think there was an outbreak in the cast and or crew. I forget which one.
Okay.
But he's really been at the forefront of making queer TV representation. I think it started off with Glee, or his first big hit was Glee. People may recognize him from that.
Yeah.
But The Prom is a beautiful, heartfelt story. I was very distracted throughout the whole movie by two things.
Okay.
One thing, James Corden's just devastating attempt at an American accent. It was, you know, there would be sentences where he would just nail it. It was perfect.
Right.
And then the next word he says, just it was a hit and then a miss. And it was, you know, clearly he's been up for 3 days practicing this one sentence, but he forgot how to say yes with an American accent. It was very off-putting. It was James Corden in pretending to be American. Very distracting. Also, James Corden was playing an openly gay man. And the character, I mean, it's based on the Broadway musical, okay?
Okay.
And the Broadway musical, this character is very gay. It's in the script. It's relevant to the plot.
Okay.
Very gay character. And James Corden was playing a very gay character. But Ryan Murphy is also openly gay. So it is an LGBT production. And that was a decision that, a gay director and writer made. But people are starting to disagree and don't think it was the best decision. In fact, there is somebody who piped up on Twitter. The quote here, I mean, I'll read the quote and you can guess if you know who it came from. Meryl Streep in The Prom deserves better than starring alongside James Corden, who is offensively playing every gay stereotype. There are incredible LGBTQIA actors that should have been cast for this role. Don't get me wrong, Meryl Streep in this was just flawless. Absolutely flawless performances. Like the rest of the cast, you're like, oh my God. And then you just get almost brought out of it by James Corden's terrible accent and overacting. But yeah, that was Jedward, for those who aren't familiar. But it got me thinking, Sebastian, and I wanted to ask you this question. It got me thinking about my prom. I came to Canada just before finishing high school, so I was able to have a Canadian prom out in the rural, in the sticks. In my high school prom, a good friend of mine at the time, who is straight, everyone I knew there at the time identified at the time as straight. He actually asked me up to a dance near the end of the night, and we danced together, and that was very sweet. And I danced with my friend Emily, but it was very sort of heartfelt and touching to have that moment as the only gay in the prom. You know what I mean? And I think that was a powerful moment for me. And I wondered if you'd had the same. Did you go to your prom? Did you have a dance at your prom? I mean, your prom was what, in 1930, 1940?
I didn't really go to my prom. A lot of people in my year didn't go to the prom. We weren't really a prom school. Like, a lot of people viewed that as like an American import. We were a science and drama school. People went to the after party of the finale of Evita. Like, that was the big event of the year. So it was very much a theater school. And people kind of looked at the prom and shrugged. And some people went, most people didn't. And it was in the 90s.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's, 10 years between us. Yours was in the 90s. Mine was in 2008, 2009, give or take, showing my age here as well for our listeners. But I think for younger folks, there is an opportunity now. The team behind The Prom have teamed up with Jonathan Van Ness of Queer Eye and Janelle Monáe.
Okay.
And DJ Galantis. And at 8 p.m. This past Saturday, because of course our listeners will be listening the following Saturday, there is a Netflix YouTube special of a prom. So people can tune in to this sort of live prom-themed prom. Wow, that's a lot of proms in one sentence. on Netflix at 8 p.m. Eastern on the YouTube. So yeah, we're pretty excited about it. It's a virtual prom for everyone. It was December 19th at 8 p.m. on Netflix's YouTube. The other story I wanted to mention before we jump to our first song, the territorial government of the Yukon has said that it will now cover the cost of PrEP, that's pre-exposure prophylactics, to those who are at risk.
Right.
Now, PrEP has been shown in studies in the UK, the US, even in Canada, that those are PrEP. It's sort of a preventative medication. Massively reduces your chance of catching HIV.
Yeah.
So for at-risk groups, this is a huge win. And it will definitely help to drive down the rates.
The most interesting thing about PrEP is that every single case of somebody who's caught HIV, despite the fact that they were on PrEP, they could show that it was either they weren't taking the pills properly, like they weren't taking them at the appropriate schedule, or there was interference from other medication. That, like, the medication itself seems, I'm not going to say it's ironclad because there's a human component there, but it seems to be as effective as a medication could possibly be, which is actually a glowing endorsement of literally anything. Like, even insulin has that kind of level of quality.
But yes, honestly, I mean, these studies, this is such a fantastic tool. Yeah. So for the Yukon, this is a great, a big deal. Now let's jump to our first song. This is Big Gay Hands by Partner. Now, let us know what you think. Big Gay Hands by Partner. We will be back just after our interviews with the Canadian LGBT Chamber of Commerce and the interview with Andrea Wilson from Inside Out, the LGBT Film Festival, coming up just after this. Welcome back to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith, and I am very excited to have Dale joining me from Canada's LGBT Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, Dale, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Luke.
One of the things that I was excited about this week was actually a program that you folks have launched around accrediting safe spaces for businesses. Are you able to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely, Luke. We've been working on this program over the last number of months. So we're very excited to be able to bring it forward to its current pilot status. So, you know, a quick background, CGLCC is our organization. We're Canada's LGBT plus Chamber of Commerce. And in partnership and collaboration with Tourism HR Canada and the federal government, we're developing a comprehensive LGBT plus safe space accreditation pilot program. And it's really aimed to help any business across, you know, the length and breadth of Canada, any business, organization, and indeed communities, certify their status as being LGBT plus friendly. So we're very excited to launch this program. We're starting first pilot in mid-January, and it'd be great to have maybe some of your listeners join us on that pilot.
Now, you mentioned that you teamed up with Tourism Canada and some of the other organizations. You know, I'm wondering what inspired that partnership. You know, what inspired the sort of collaboration between yourselves and the government on this particular project?
Yeah, and that's a great question, Luke. You know, we know from research that CGLCC conducted earlier this year, you know, that we know that, first of all, the LGBT plus tourist market is worth $12 billion every year. So it's a sizable market. But one of the key bits of information that we've got from that is that whenever LGBT plus travelers are looking to travel, and especially in Canada, safety is actually one of their primary concerns. So, you know, taking that into account, but then just more generally, we, like, 2020 really has been the year where diversity, equity, and inclusion has been at the forefront of society. And I think, you know, certainly as we look to this a business angle, that, you know, one, it definitely makes business sense to ensure that your businesses are operating and supportive of the LGBT plus customer, but also inclusion just makes sense. And we think it's time for businesses to, you know, join us on this journey as we look to ensure that businesses that are safe spaces for LGBT plus customers are accredited and recognized for doing such.
Now, it's funny you mention that, because I was chatting with my partner, Jake, and I realized that we are actually pretty discerning dinks. That's double income, no kids, for those who aren't familiar.
Yes.
And, you know, I was talking about scratching Hungary, the entire country, off my list of places, you know, to go and visit. Of course, they've recently just banned, constitutionally banned, same-sex adoption. So things aren't looking great over there. So you're absolutely right. You know, we don't have the luxury of just strolling into any space and assuming that it will be safe and friendly and wonderful. You know, is this something that the rural economy can get behind, like organizations in, you know, Tweed or Halliburton or Abbotsford?
Absolutely, Luke. You know, I really want to emphasize, you know, to all of your listeners, this program is from coast to coast to coast. We want this to be a program that we have accredited businesses in urban and rural Canada to, you know, There are lots of great companies located everywhere across Canada. And we just want, you know, those businesses that are actually inclusive businesses and inclusive spaces and, you know, are doing really great work on the ground to ensure that LGBT plus customers are accommodated and supported, that they're recognized. So, like, this is, you know, a pan-Canadian partnership, I think. And I think it's a great opportunity for rural Canada to support their local LGBT community. But also there's an opportunity here to attract tourism. You know, we've seen, given COVID-19, how, you know, planes are definitely grounded. And we've seen a lot of Canadians, I think, you know, rediscover their local provinces and local regions. And I think from a business perspective, this is an opportunity for local businesses to think about how do they attract LGBT plus travelers and how do they attract and support the existing LGBT plus customers in their surrounding area.
Now, a lot of the business owners I know, they're going to say, you know, money's money. You know, they don't actively discriminate just because of who you walk in the store with. But how are you doing this accreditation? You know, how does one become an accredited safe space? What does that entail?
Yeah, so accredited businesses, they're going to benefit from guidelines that provide information and advice and resources on ensuring that LGBT plus customers, you know, feel welcome and accepted. And accredited businesses will be able to demonstrate and market themselves as safe destinations for the LGBT plus market with progressive policies and practices, as well as exceptional service standards. And then in terms of the process, you know, applicants will undergo a formal review of their business or organizational efforts. So a business will be asked to provide proof of the efforts and that they meet the program standards. There are four criteria categories in which an organization will need to meet, and they'll need to provide evidence both internally and externally to back it up. And they span a culture of inclusivity, policies and practices, training, and also commitment to inclusive leadership. So it's quite a detailed and assured process, but it needs to be, because we need to ensure that businesses that we're accrediting are indeed supportive of the LGBT plus consumer. If we accredit a business as being LGBT plus friendly, you know, we have to stand over that because it's going to be our accreditation program. And we think that this is going to be, you know, a detailed program that will be able to, you know, stand the test, I think. As we go through this, you know, it's also about bringing other businesses with us. You know, there's a lot to learn. And part of this program is going to be about, you know, providing information and providing support to ensure that businesses and organizations, you know, have the information and have the know-how to effectively and properly serve and support the LGBT plus community.
You know, I think reaching new audiences and bringing, you know, more folks into businesses is more vital now than ever before.
Absolutely.
You know, 2020 has decimated, you know, the retail sector across Canada. It has decimated the restaurant industry. And I think there's a lot more people thinking critically about buying local and doing staycations. It's definitely, you know, a great program. How can businesses get involved if they want to do something like this locally?
Yeah, and just quickly add, Luke, like I think the diversity dollar, I think 2020 is definitely the year of that, where diverse communities, they vote with their feet and I think they want to be supported. And I think, you know, the same applies in business. You know, if you're looking to attract the LGBT plus consumer, you know, you have to do that in a real authentic way. And I think, you know, this program will be able to certainly help businesses attract and continue to support their LGBT plus customers. For any business who is listening and is attracted to this program, I mentioned that we are doing a pilot program. So we aren't fully launched yet. We're going to launch it towards the end of March, but we are doing a pilot test program starting in mid-January. And for any business, and I really want to emphasize, we really want rural businesses to be a part of this program. If you visit cglcc.ca, and if you visit our program section, you'll see the LGBT plus Safe Space Accreditation Pilot Program section, where you'll be able to learn all about it and perhaps sign up as one of our pilot test businesses to go through the process in mid-January.
Well, thank you so much there for coming and speaking with me. I really appreciate it. And I think this is such a fantastic program, and I really hope that businesses make use of it, because gay folks do pay attention. We want to make sure that those businesses are getting our dollars and are being supported. So I want to thank you for your work on this.
You know, Luke, it's been a really difficult year. You know, our organization, you know, we work and represent LGBT plus small businesses across Canada. They've been decimated as a result of COVID-19. As we look towards ending 2020 and hopefully turning to a brighter year in 2021, this is one of the more exciting parts of the work that we're doing. And I think it's going to play a really big part as every business looks towards COVID recovery. This is a really significant program. And I think it's going to play a big part, especially as we look towards COVID recovery.
Well, you have a great day. And thank you again so much for joining me today for and speaking about this.
Thanks so much, Luke. And have a great holiday season. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Hello and welcome back to Cancri, home of Canada's Queer Major. My name is Luke Smith. And I am actually here with one of my favorite guests that we have once a year. I was disappointed not to be able to do the interview in person. I'm joined by Andrea Wilson. Thank you so much for joining us. I think this is a great chance to sort of touch base with Inside Out and yourself. 2020 has been a really rough year, an incredibly rough year. The process of viewing film and coming together in a festival, which is really your raison d'etre, it's very much an in-person event. How on earth did you manage to make that work?
You know, when you put it that way, you know, you're absolutely right. It was, you know, I think in the months that have passed since the pandemic really reaching its global status in March, I think we've kind of forgotten already, or just the trauma has kind of made us forget what those first weeks were like in terms of just that trying to reconcile and understand, you know, how does our work, our life's work, our, you know, the way we serve our publics and our communities, like how can that continue? How will it continue? Are we focusing on the right things? Are we making the right choices? You know, it was really you know, a challenging process for all of that decision making, you know, in those early weeks and months and that continuation through the year. So, you know, in our case, we without question benefited greatly from our network of industry colleagues and other festivals. Like we absolutely didn't do any work alone. It was, you know, an almost constant set of conversations and Zoom calls and phone calls and brainstorms, you know, with other festival leadership on, you know, how can we really work collaboratively to make decisions that are going to, you know, support our communities, be that our filmmakers, our audiences, our supporters, you know, how are we going to really get on the same page about this and have a collective approach? So that was critical. And, you know, for a festival like ours, you know, our Toronto festival typically takes place in May. So we were also under the clock quite a bit in terms of having to make a call about what to do. You know, what to do immediately, as well as what to do in the future. And so we decided to postpone the main festival until the fall. And in the end, you know, delivered it as a, you know, what we called a digital first edition of the festival. But that postponement and, you know, the support we received around taking that step was really critical for us in just not having to make those decisions in such intensity, and to be able to really build a plan and a strategy over those months so that we could, you know, put something together in October that we were all really proud of.
You know, I think the postponement and, you know, not having an in-person event in May, you know, demonstrated that you are obviously respecting the health and lives of your patrons, your guests, but also the communities. You know, it really was not the time to be gathering. And I think you folks made definitely the right decision on that one. You know, according to the hardest hit coalition, which is tourism, hotels, festivals, you know, some organizations lost upwards of 90% of their income this year because everything just had to close. You know, you had your 30th anniversary. You're one of the, I believe, if not the oldest, longest running LGBT festival in Canada. Did this bring Inside Out to its knees? Are you financially doing okay? How are you holding on as an organization?
I mean, there were some immediate financial challenges that we had to reckon with. You know, I'm very proud of the fact that over the last 4 years, we really have diversified our revenue streams overall as an organization. So we're not in a position where we're fully reliant on any one source of income. And that's a very, very privileged position to be in. And it's taken, you know, a lot of work from a lot of folks involved in the organization to make that a reality. But all that said, you know, looking down the barrel of a year where we really, our immediate concern was that we would not be able to earn any revenue. We wouldn't be able to earn any box office revenue from ticket sales. We wouldn't be able to earn any, you know, bar revenue from our special events. And the very real fear that us and many organizations like ours had is that we're going to lose our base of support outside of that, you know, ticket sales. We're going to lose our sponsors. We're going to lose our, you know, our members and donors because we can't deliver them this in-person festival that we've promised. And what we were, you know, incredibly bolstered by was, you know, all of our major sponsors said, we're committed to you, we're committed to the work of the organization, whether it's a postponement or a cancellation or whatever you need to do as an organization for 2020, you can count on our continued commitment. So we had that base of support. Being in Canada, obviously, we're very privileged in terms of our government's supporters, our government funders. So we were able to maintain all of our, you know, annual support from those funders and arts councils, as well as access some of the emergency supports. Accessing the federal wage subsidy allowed us to not just continue to keep the majority of our staff on, but actually to extend their contracts because of the postponement. So, you know, at the time that we made the decision to postpone, we were, you know, only 6 weeks away from the festival. So we had quite a large team on staff. And we were able to almost across the board keep all of those folks on with the support of the federal wage subsidy. So, you know, at this point, I can't believe I'm saying this, but, you know, as I have been, you know, doing this work the last couple of months around the transition and getting the house in order, Inside Out is actually in a really strong financial position going into 2021, which, you know, 9 months ago would not have been my expectation, despite, you know, trying to remain optimistic. So it's definitely been a journey, but I'm really relieved and happy with where we've landed. And, you know, the big question marks are going to be into 2021, of course. What does that continued support look like? And without those short-term emergency funds or subsidies, can Inside Out and organizations like it, you know, continue to diversify revenue, continue to find new ways to grow and function in this new world and in these new models of film exhibition?
You know, I think it's quite interesting that during this pandemic, the value of good storytelling, of good television, good movies really came to the fore because everybody was stuck at home, quarantined, watching Netflix or watching whatever it may be, you know. So people are making a lot more use. I would argue people have enjoyed movies and television perhaps more this year than they would normally ever have, because everyone is you know, in their own homes. And I think that my question now pivots to the those content creators, like folks who are making these incredible movies and so on. I know that you actually launched a digital or an online initiative, the Out on Set initiative, which is, I think, just a great way of pivoting into a digital space and working to provide that opportunity. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
For sure. Well, you know, the last few years we've been growing our partnership with Out TV, and what a lot of that growth has looked like has been, you know, how are we making new opportunities for filmmakers and creators, new paid opportunities? How are we connecting the dots? You know, Out TV is a Canadian company, a Canadian broadcaster. How are we ensuring that there's a pipeline of LGBTQ creatives in Canada that are connected to Out TV and those, you know, funding and financing opportunities that might be available for their work? And one of the things that we had been talking about over the last couple of years is, you know, Inside Out gets a lot of outreach from producers, from studios, from, you know, executives looking for talent, looking for Canadian LGBTQ creatives that might be, you know, someone who should be in a writer's room, or they're looking for a specific, you know, crew role on set, and they want someone who is part of the LGBTQ community. And some of our colleagues, in particular, like Real World has launched the exceptional database Access Real World for Black, Indigenous, and people of color creatives. There's also BIPOC TV and Film has partnered with Bell to launch Hire BIPOC this year as well. There's also Film in Color. And there, I think, is a great opportunity to add to all of that exceptional work by creating a database for specifically LGBTQ creatives and crew, which obviously there's going to be crossover and intersection with those other databases, but it's really just trying to address that duality of, you know, individuals, producers, studios, agencies, etc., are coming to Inside Out looking for talent, and Out TV is, you know, looking to build production pipelines and, you know, really populate their world with a robust crew of LGBTQ creatives. So there was a great synergy there. So the end result is Out on Set, which as of right now has been launched as an initiative to really, you know, recruit LGBTQ folks to sign up, create a profile. And then when the database launches in the first quarter of 2021, it will be a one-stop shop for folks that are making content in Canada and want to employ LGBTQ crew and creatives. So I'm really excited to have gotten this off the ground. And I think, you know, like you said, with people being at home, this kind of shift in how we're living, how we're working, of course, in the film industry in particular, you know, our work life has really changed. This is such a great opportunity to build something that can really serve, I think, the industry in the future. So that was really the goal there.
And there is some really strong Canadian talent. I think the Canadian Oscar submission this year, for example, just for a listener's sake, is Funny Boy by Deepa Nameta. And just what an exciting, great film to see promoted internationally. Now, for our listeners across Canada, I think one of the things that I wanted to highlight in this call is the library that you have available in terms of... I think it's one of your year-round supports available. Can you tell us a little bit about that and sort of how and why some folks may want to make use of it?
Absolutely. This is a resource that I'm so, so excited about. It was developed because, it was all developed pre-pandemic, honestly, as an online resource. And the reason why it was created is that Inside Out and many other organizations like Inside Out have had programs of, you know, taking film content, you know, into the schools or into community organizations or libraries or public spaces. And one of the challenges that Inside Out faced was that kind of programming and that kind of program delivery was really cost prohibitive. It was really expensive to take the show on the road, you know, and essentially run an educational touring business in addition to the film festival model. So what we 3 years ago kind of started to strategize on was, you know, what if we instead just gave educators and community organizers and the people that are booking us to come to their institution, what if we just give them the content with the materials that they need to create curriculum or programming around it, and make that a free resource that's just available to them. So after several years of consultation and development, what we launched is the library. You can find it online at insidethelibrary.ca or link directly from our website, insideout.ca. And it is short film content, LGBTQ short films, primarily those that have been created by LGBTQ filmmakers. And these are all films that have been created, rated, et cetera, for young audiences. There's information on the site that sort of indicates what the target age ranges are for the content or grade levels. And there's also accompanying educational content, so study guides, teaching guides for these films. So even if you're an educator who, you know, hasn't had a ton of access to teachings on these issues, those resources are available so that it can contextualize and enhance the experience of watching the film, and also help to present it in a, you know, a safe space that will support, you know, students or community members that might be struggling with some of the issues in the films. And that, you know, it's not just like a, you know, watch this and your learning is over. It's a more integrated experience. So what's up right now on the library is essentially the beta version of the site. There's about 20 films that have their content available. All the films are captioned as well. And in the first half of 2021, the library will be expanded into its kind of full and final version that'll include about 40 additional films, and content, as well as the ability to curate your own shorts program and some other really cool features. And that's available, yeah, for completely free all across Canada. You just need to sign up for a free account and you can access it.
I think for any educators listening who are struggling to come up with things to do in the digital space with online learning, this might be a pretty cool tool to tap into. I know, for example, in Quebec, there is conversations about maybe going sort of online only for school for a little while, and sort of where we'll see where it goes. But what a you know, silver lining just happened to be well-timed resource. I mean, that must have been a bit of a happy day when you guys realized that this could really step in and be a great help at this particular moment.
It was definitely a kind of outcome we hadn't predicted. I mean, we saw this as an opportunity to you know, connect and support teachers in the classroom. But throughout development, I mean, we weren't even really thinking about the virtual learning reality that exists now, you know? So definitely happy to be able to provide any support. I mean, our teachers are, you know, what they've had to go through this year, it's just been endlessly challenging. So I think to be able to provide this resource is something I'm really happy about.
Well, what's made me, you know, very proud to be able to support Inside Out is just the incredible work that you have done to provide resources for those who can't physically get to a festival because of the whole pandemic that ended the world for a little bit back there. Mm-hmm. And it's just great to see that you were able to pivot with the 30th anniversary and also that the library is available nationwide. I want to thank you so much again for joining me, and we hope you are gonna. We wish you every success as you move into your new role, wherever that may be, and hopefully we'll be able to keep in touch. But thank you so much again, and we hope that folks check out insideout.ca to see the details about some of the programs that we went over.
Oh, thank you so much. Always such a pleasure to chat. And absolutely, we will find a way to collaborate in the future.
I never want
and welcome back. That was Sam Sparrow's Everything. So one of the stories that came out this week is revenge that took, I think it was 12 years in the making. This is 12-year revenge, which is absolutely fantastic. Let me, Gawker Media, it was a media outlet online.
Yes.
That it outed a couple of people, and they actually got sued into oblivion. The lawsuits really shut them down. But Apple TV had planned on creating a series about them called Scrapers. It had been pitched by former staff at Gawker, according to LGBTQNation.com and some other sources. They were teaming up with these former Gawker staff and editors to make this show about this media organization online that upset the wrong people and got sued into oblivion. It was a bit of a high-stakes drama, except it turns out one of the people that this scrappy media upstart had outed, causing all kinds of personal challenges for, was Tim Cook,
right,
the at-the-time CEO of Apple, and now the at-this-time CEO of Apple 12 years later. And did you know it, but Apple TV is actually owned by Apple. Tim Cook, and not that he's holding a grudge for 12 years, but he certainly wasn't keen on the people responsible for outing him and causing massive disruptions to his life, being paid large sums of money to make a TV show on the company
dime. Gawker actually comes down to a lot of this. The thing that really started their downward spiral was they had accused Hulk Hogan of being gay, and he sued them into oblivion. And I remember there's one interview where he actually made it very clear, I just want to say, I'm not homophobic. Here's the thing. If you're going to say something about somebody and you're in a media outlet, you better be telling the truth. Then he went on saying, he's Hulk Hogan. He's 6'9". He's a giant, incredibly famous, incredibly rich. His career is over now. He has no reason to be in the closet. He's like, let me tell you, brother, if I were gay, I would have come on a long time.
Hulk Hogan was bankrolled by the billionaire Peter Thiel, who is now openly gay, after Gawker also outed him. If their whole raison d'etre at the time was just going around outing billionaires, it is hardly surprising that when they try and get a job 12 years later, that some of these guys are just going to remember those things.
It's just so crass.
I think it's great that Tim Cook got his revenge 12 years later in axing this this new TV show from Apple TV. Next week, we have the Big Gay Quiz of the Year. We're very excited about that. We've recorded that a couple of weeks ago. And then we will be back to normal recording the shows after that. So yeah, it's going to be a pretty exciting couple of weeks. And I think we have some interviews planned for our early New Year's shows as well.
You're going to make me go to the Kuiper Belt again.
I'm going to make you travel all the way to the burbs.
Yeah. The Kuiper Belt, by the way, is the halo of asteroids that's out beyond Pluto. And I refer to the suburbs as the Kuiper Belt.
Well, we're going to be playing out with Invaders by the Peptides. So when you think of the far-off planet being described by the Peptides, just visualize the suburbs. It's pretty much the same thing. I've been Luke Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. Thanks for listening.